Necessitates sense perception, or a world that is guided by sense certainty, right? Because if you have an entire, well, no, because you need an entire population to remain solely guided by their instincts and you know, self-gratifying desires, you know, in order to be able to govern them to a certain extent. In other words, you need to keep a population stupid if you want to be able to continue an empire. So, I'd like to start with this one thought put forth by LaRouche. No. Yeah. Next. Yeah. Does someone want to read that loudly? Yeah.
Happiness lies, for us, in what we do to secure the future of mankind, and what we do to accomplish this by such enterprises as improvements in the livable state of our planet today and of our solar system for times beyond.
This should sound familiar by now. okay. So, now, how is it, you are probably all wondering, that this movement is actually going to save civilization? How is it that studying Kepler and Bach and this is actually going to ensure a future for humanity?
Maybe because they belong those persons to another kind of human being, you know, like they were more evolved in their time, and it's related to us today. We have some maybe people that are the same like them, and they get a secret from their heart or in their gene to transfer generation to generation. And the music is, you know, something that is all over the world, even when we don't
speak. Yeah, it elevates people. It elevates people.
And we all like the music we like now.
Okay.
And the, you know, plants, they like the music that is kind of soft or pacific music. Classic too, but I mean, it's hard work. Sometimes the plants, they poor living.
They live shorter lives.
They turn into cannibals.
Okay. Well, okay. To get a sense of this, firstly, it's important to look at, in order to know what will be necessary to defeat the threat of imperialism, fascism, we have to look at what was successful in defeating imperialism in the past. And for this, it's good to look at the Renaissance, because not simply was it a whole lot of great discoveries, although there were many, but this was actually the defeat of the dominant empires of the time, like the Roman, the Venetian empires. So, for those of you who know what the ideas of the Renaissance were based on, then you'll get a sense of this idea of imago viva Dei, Latin for God or man in the living image of God, the Creator. And what was developed during this time was, under this principle, was the development of the intellectual, and thus increasing tremendously man's power over nature, and also man's ability to communicate profound ideas in a social process. So you have this type of mastery of principle reoccurring throughout the Renaissance, but like its name, it's called the Renaissance, right? So this actually comes from ideas that have at one time prior dominated the culture of Greece, for example, Athens, around the time of Plato, or even before, right? The Pythagoreans demonstrated these same ideas. So what you really had coming out of this, if you've looked at Plato, is this idea of hypothesis, to come to know, to make a surmise. And that ideas was in fact the image, the living image of God the Creator. So, do you have that? You wanna read that out again?
Sure.
Here's Plato.
This, then, is the class that I described as intelligible. It is true, but with the reservation first that the soul is compelled to employ assumptions in the investigation of it, not proceeding to a first principle because of its inability to extricate itself from and rise above its assumptions, and second, that it uses as images or likenesses the very objects that are themselves copied and adumbrated by the class below them, and that in comparison with these latter are esteemed as clear and held in honor. And by the other section of the intelligible, I mean that which the mind itself lays hold of by the powers of dialectics, treating its assumptions not as absolute beginnings, but literally as hypotheses, underpinnings, footings, and springboards, so to speak, to enable it to rise to that which requires no assumption and is the starting point of all. And after attaining to that again, taking hold of the first dependencies from it, so to proceed downward to the conclusion, making no use whatever of any object of sense, but only of pure ideas, moving on through ideas to ideas and ending with ideas.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot in there. Does anyone have a question or comment?
I want to know who's the author of that.
This is Plato.
Plato.
Mm-hmm. See. No, that was LaRouche. Lyndon LaRouche. No, he's living today. He's leading this
mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's leading this fight that we're involved in, that we're engaged in. You'll get to know a little bit more about him.
Is he a political?
He is.
He is.
He is.
Is it a person?
He's also.
Last election.
Okay, you'll get to know all about him. Okay. So Plato clearly here is reflecting the same principles that sprung forth in the Renaissance, right? That mankind could actually come to know through surmise, through hypothesis, and then and rehypothesis, and what he called hypothesizing the higher hypothesis. Now. This is it's an interesting question when you're looking at ancient Greece and then the Renaissance to look at this gap in between. You know, why didn't these ideas simply just develop, you know, throughout time? You know, why was there a need for a Renaissance of these ideas? And this is largely the cause of sophistry introduced in Greece during the time that these ideas were dominating and allowing Athens to become the most developed culture. And this sophistry introduced was largely the work of Aristotelian ideas, where Aristotle brought forth this idea that you can't really know anything other than what you can know through your sense perception. And so, essentially, all you can do is describe what you see. So, and you can just describe what you see with some type of a mathematical deductive system. And that is all that you can really know. Anything causing you to need to develop that description would be metaphysical, a metaphysical cause, which you can't actually come to know because it's outside of the realm of man's ability. So essentially what he's saying is that you can't actually know causes. You can't actually come to know the cause of things, and so asking why is virtually useless. And this, in a sense, is the type of thing that is aimed to reduce mankind to to being governed by the same principles that govern animals. So, now, what came after this period, without going into the detail here, in kind of a broad picture, was the rise of empire, namely the Roman Empire, dominated by these same ideas, Aristotelian ideas, right? And to a large extent, this is why the empire was able to last that long, because you had an entire population that didn't think that they could come to know anything. So, this is just a brief, or I don't really want to stress this too much, but just to give people a sense that, at that time of the split of the Roman Empire, you had the rise of the Venetian Empire. People, if they've looked at this period, probably have a sense that the Venetian Empire, though not usually talked about so much in school, was actually the greatest financial oligarchy ever to exist up until that time. And they virtually controlled all of trading and finances throughout the Mediterranean world. So what they're responsible for around the, 1000 AD onwards, is the hiring of the Norman chivalry specifically for the launching of the Crusades. Right? People remember these. And a lot of the time, they might have a certain sense of the reason for the Crusades as being the conquering of the Holy Land and things like this. But actually, what you're looking at was this Arabic Renaissance, which was occurring in the East, which, in order to ensure the continuation of the empire, had to be destroyed. The Renaissance that was occurring throughout the Arabic world. There was like a Renaissance around like the 900s or so, and you had a whole counterattack by the leading empire of the time, which was the Venetian Empire, to destroy that.
I can't understand. Is it you mean that the Arabian people, like Muslims?
Yeah. No, what I'm saying is they were reviving the ideas of Plato. They were, and you had a complete, yes, and around 900 AD, and you had a whole, what's known as the Arabic Renaissance, right?
So the original writings of Plato were known in Western Europe. They were translated from the Arabic to Latin, for instance, in the 1400s. They knew Plato before
us.
What was
Alexandria? I don't
know. It's a whole other presentation. Well, I mean, there's a reason why Plato comes to the Western world through the Arabic language.
Hmm.
I think the library at Alexandria was destroyed, and the original Greek.
The thing is that in 800, we have the Romal Rashid, who was the greatest Renaissance man.
It's through the Arabic language that we have.
Can I answer your question?
Paul just answered him, and then you talked at the same time.
Harumal Rashid, he was paying gold for any book of knowledge who can be translated to Arabic. So the thing is, he was going all over the world, he was buying books, he was paying gold, he was buying knowledge, and he was building libraries. So the thing is, after the rest of the civilization in Europe was completely destroyed, the book, the translation of Harumal Rashid, was there.
That was in Andalusia in southern Spain.
Okay. So you have this occurring throughout the Arabic world, which poses a threat to the leading empire of Venice at the time. And now, due to the launching of the Crusades and then spread of the Black Plague, the economic conditions started to deplete, leaving it more difficult for Rome to maintain its dominance, Venice, right? So this is kind of the background that Nicholas of Cusa, Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa, steps into. And what he was doing was, he was building a movement to overthrow the oligarchic domination of the church, because the church at the time was completely corrupted by these same ideas, right? These same Aristotelian ideas. And what he does through building the Council of Florence is a regroupment of all priests across the Mediterranean world to discuss and revive the true principles of the Catholic Church, which had been corrupted. Right. So now he does this, through the revival of these same ideas, which is imago viva Dei, that man represents the living embodiment of the creator of the universe, and thus expressing the principle of creativity. So, you had the complete abolishing of Aristotle due to this, and a renaissance starts to pick up. So what happened was, now man's power, as a creature in the universe, tremendously increased. And this was done through looking at this question of man and the mind and the relationship of man's mind to the universe or the creator of the universe, right? And so looking at the mind of man's relationship to God, the creator. Now, okay, so how would you start to do that? How do you investigate your relationship to God? How do you come to know whether or not the universe was created? Yeah, sure. Yeah, sure. The cat. Yeah.
There was someone over there upstairs creating that gave us the power to understand him.
But how do you know? How do you know it's not a fantasy, but you know to be true?
It may be because some people on Earth right now or before that have that knowledge in themselves.
This is something you see reoccurring in theology. It's always the same principle. Really, no matter what religion you're looking at, in its purest form, comes back to this same idea, right? The universe as being created, and the relationship of man to God. That's what it seems that no matter what religion you're looking at, seems to point in that direction. Hinduism, which has many gods, has one creator god. So unless you're looking at a pagan religion, whether you're just looking at worshiping.
When we're thinking about the Zero In, they thought they were our gods.
Okay.
Reality. It's not true.
I don't know, but... Well, but let's investigate that, because see, the question is, how would you start to investigate that? How would you try to come to know that? Now, wait, no, think about it, okay. Oh, because this is not something that you can just, this is something that has been, contemplated for many, many years. But really what you're dealing with when you're thinking of the creation is, what do you think of when you're thinking about, say, the absolute beginning of things? Or you'd be, just hold on. Well, let it sink in your mind and think about it for a little bit. Okay. So you would be thinking about maybe in the beginning, what was there in the beginning? Or, you know, was there anything? Or was there nothing? There wasn't everything, but there wasn't nothing. And so, what you may be looking at in this absolute nothingness, in a sense, that continuously maybe expands, forever, is not just absolute nothingness, although it may seem to be, but it's an absolute unity, and therefore one thing, right? So you're looking at this absolute oneness, or, without any division, right? Absolute truth and knowledge, or God, and you want to come to understand man's mind's relationship to this. So, I mean, this is an interesting thing, because is man the same thing as this absolute oneness? When you're looking at the potential of the human mind to come to know something through a process of, say, hypothesis and then elimination, what you're looking at is differentiation of things. Or in other words, otherness, which is different than something that is whole, right? And so, what... No.
Okay.
No. I mean, men... Well,
there must have been another thing before the life, before everything that has been created. Suggest that maybe God was not
alone. Can you just listen to, because she can do the presentation?
Yeah, we should take questions after, because Okay. Yeah. No, it's a good idea to take questions at the end, because I mean, I don't claim to know everything, but these are ideas that were thought about. Right, and looking at the nature of man, necessitates a certain ability to differentiate. And now that, on its own, brings about this idea of multitude. Because when you're looking at the difference between things, you're now looking at numerous things, which is not one thing. And so the mind of man, which begets magnitude and multitude through number and differentiation or otherness, is not that the same as that oneness. However, is not completely and solely, similar to the the world of perception, you know, and separation, because you would use what you find in the sensual world in order to come to know that one. And so you need an idea of the one, right? That idea of oneness must precede, you need an idea of the one in order to use what you can in the sensual world to come to know the one, right? So in a sense, you can look at the mind of man as the mean in between the two. So, but I mean, this is the type of thing that these guys were looking into, and you had a certain understanding of the interconnectivity of these types of things. For example, if you have now different types of onenesses. Now this is a little bit of a different idea, but you can get a sense of that because you can look at reason and mankind's ability to reason, this reason in and of itself as a certain oneness of being. Just as you can look at the perceptual world, right, or all other living creatures and that type of being as a certain oneness in its own. Now, just as, for example, the soul of mankind would, in a sense, supersede or embody or be of a more perfect oneness than that of the perceptual world, well, there are different types of reason, right? Where you can be a reasonable being, but you may not be fully expressing your complete potential, and that would necessitate, the being of your intellect, let's say. And so, therefore, just as your reason and soul would, in a sense, subsume the being of your sense perception, the intellectual oneness of your being would subsume the oneness of your soul or of reason. And similarly, just as the absolute oneness, God the Creator, would subsume the oneness of your intellect. But all types of levels of being are still, in a sense, governed by this overarching principle of absolute oneness. And just, and the interconnectivity of them all comes from an understanding that you would need the other in order to come to absolute oneness, right? That you would need to use the realm of your sense perceptions in order to achieve the utmost potential of your intellectual oneness, so that you can truly be in the likeness of absolute oneness, or God the Creator. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, I was wondering what you said previously. Was that Nicholas Cusa? Sort of a synopsis of his philosophy?
These are Renaissance ideas. I mean, This, I mean, Nicholas of Cusa, surely, surely was you know, propagating this, these types of ideas, but more so than looking at this as being Nicholas of Cusa or Plato, look at this as being the principles that order the development of mankind's relationship in the sense that it can come to know the orderings and harmonies in the universe. So, yeah. Okay. Now, the revival of these types of ideas, right, how this type of thing ends up improving tremendously the conditions of life for mankind because it improved the powers of the mind. Although, none of this comes without a counterattack, right, launched from Venice at the time, you know, namely led by a fellow named Paolo Sarpi, whom, if you guys have ever looked into, I mean, he basically is responsible for reviving Aristotle, although he says that he is against Aristotle. And rather than saying, he's actually worse because he's a complete sophist, you know, rather than saying that, you know, that mankind, you know, can't really come to know anything. He says, sure, you know, mankind can come to know, but can only know what it has deduced logically through its mathematical deductive system, which is just a nice play on words to re-say what Aristotle was saying. The revival of these same ideas that, you know, there is no knowledge without sense, without sensation, are what leads Sarpi to actually influence modern, all these Locke, Hobbes, all these guys that that are responsible for inspiring the modern existential movement. And these ideas that God is dead is a complete counterattack on the ideas of the Renaissance. So just to give you a little bit of the background noise that Kepler was walking into. Now the power of man as as a reflection of the power that moves the universe allows for a defiant Kepler to step into the situation at the time and actually demonstrate a proof of principle and launching all of the foundation for what was then to become what we know of as modern science. So, all right. Now, I mean, he comes in, and this is the man responsible for the discovery of universal gravitation. Despite many of you may think that it's Newton, Kepler, discovered the orbits as being actual ellipses and not perfect circles, and that the planets were moved due to a certain principle, gravitation. How were these discoveries made? All right. Well, you had several astronomers of the time at the time, and none of them were able to come anywhere near what Kepler was able to discover. So, the question is how was this done? How were the greatest discoveries of the past actually discovered? Now, when you're looking at the nighttime sky, one question that a lot of these astronomers would ask is, what is moving? Is it the sun? Because I see it go around the Earth every day. Or is it the Earth? And you can battle this out. And how do you actually know? I know it's the Earth because I learned it in school. Or something like that, right? But how do you come to know something like that? So, one thing is that Kepler began his investigation by asking the question, what is the mover? Rather than, which one is being moved? And this allowed for a certain investigation into something which might otherwise seem very chaotic. Yeah. Now, it's interesting to look up at the sky on a clear night, 2007, and have a certain inner peace to know that that may be Mars, and we're safely rotating on our planet around the sun, and everything's okay. We're going about in our solar system. But initially, some of these things had to be discovered. So where do you start? Do you have that really messy one?
With a lot of stars?
Yeah.
I have a lot of stars, actually. The next one is...
Do it. Anyways, you guys can all picture in your minds, at least, how the star would look on a really clear night out in the up north. It's very difficult to find the Big Dipper, which is a point of fire. So, okay. So where do you start? Now, one thing that was noticed was certain recurrent motions that seemed very out of the ordinary. Yeah, this is somewhat of an approximation, but you can probably have something nicer in your mind's eye. Do you have the retrograde? Oh, it's slow, huh? You didn't. Okay, well, that's fine. Okay, so look, if you're looking at this you're an astronomer in ancient times, and you're making observations, what you would observe is that those stars, which seem farthest away from you, move least compared to something relatively closer. And after a series of evenings, may seem to move in the sky. Now, this is a snapshot taken over 2.5 weeks. But look at what this is doing. This is Mars, by the way. Do you guys see that? What was that? Why does it do that?
Do it again.
Whoa, that's going backwards. Now, this happens approximately every 2 years and a month or so. Right? This actually happens. You can actually see this in the sky when you're observing Mars. Right? It does this. So what's going on here?
Oh, just don't know, right?
Yeah, right.
Is Mars really doing a loop in this in the nighttime sky?
Yeah. Are you just dreaming here? Are you hallucinating? Or?
Well, if you trust your sense perception, it looks like it's doing a loop.
Yeah. If you trust your sense perception, it looks like it's doing a loop. And that's exactly what all other astronomers of the time had done, right? Because they feared or refused to move away from Aristotle's skirt. And actually hypothesize about the real motion of Mars. And so a lot of them constructed models to explain this or to account for this, which actually included really radical epicycles, like all kinds of rotations around the orbit to explain, you know, to demonstrate how Mars could possibly be actually physically doing this type of loop. Now that's a good point, right? Because if you're only relying on your sense perception, can you actually come to know what's happening in the universe? Do we have the? This is over a 2.5 week period. This is what you'll see Mars do.
So you got another planet in the background too.
Yeah. Okay, so do you have the models? Just to give a sense, the three different models. I mean, each of these guys had, I don't know if you guys, maybe some of you guys know the hypotheses of the time. You had the prevalent astronomers were Ptolemy, Copernicus, Tycho Brahe. You guys know what their models were, what their hypotheses were about the ordering of the solar system? Huh? What? Ptolemy, for example. You know what he thought the solar system was like?
That everything turns around the Earth, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, Ptolemy had the Earth in the center of the universe. It was the first hypothesis, I guess, that might have occurred to you if you're looking at the nighttime sky. You're seeing everything go around you. All right, so this is, I mean, he built his model making himself the center of the universe. Right, you had the sun and all the planets go around the Earth. Brahe. Anyone know what Brahe's model was? You know?
Me?
Yeah, you. Bra.
Professor. The Tycho Brahe model, was it the one with the endless circles? Or that was the Aristotle model?
Well, they all kind of add a lot of circles.
Was the Tycho Brahe model with
what's in the center?
Yeah, you want to know, I mean, was it heliocentric? Did it have the Earth in the center of the universe? Or was the Sun used as the center?
The exhaust both possibilities, of the Earth and the Sun?
No, most of them picked one.
Really?
Yeah, it was a big thing at the time. I mean, it was almost becoming a political thing or a popular thing. Who you would pick to side with, what you thought was the actual ordering.
And Brahe didn't side with either faction?
No, Brahe had his own model, which was the Earth in the center, and the Sun was going around the Earth, but all planets were going around the Sun, which was going around the Earth.
He didn't want to make anybody upset, so.
Right. How about Copernicus?
Copernicus, the Sun.
Yeah, Copernicus has the Sun in the center. Okay. Yeah, you even got the epicycle there, huh? Jeez, I guess, okay, so you've got, okay, this is a good little model, briefly. You've got Copernicus over here, the sun in the center, and the planets going around the sun. Copernicus has, Ptolemy has the sun, the Earth in the center, and the planets, the sun and planets going around the Earth, and going on around an epicycle, which is going around the Earth. And why would he do that? Anyone have an idea? Yeah, that's, I mean, this is a lot of time what these guys were using. Adding a physical design that would explain what they physically see, rather than trying to figure out what is actually causing what you see. Right? Because we now know that the planet Mars doesn't actually physically do a loop, right? But that you only see a loop because of the way that the Earth moves past the planet, right? You'll pass planet Mars, what you'll see is through the pulling, right? As it's passing, you'll see Mars do type of a, it'll appear to be going backwards because you're moving towards it quicker. Then when you pass it, then it appears to be going back forward again. Right? But this is the problem with this type of thinking. Right? Another thing, I mean, none of these actually incorporated the real sun into their models. They all of them use what Kepler calls the mean sun, because it's a point, right, like an average distance away from the actual sun, right, around which the planet would sweep out equal angles, equal angles for equal times for the Earth's orbit, let's say. You're looking at the Earth's orbit. So, I mean, that was already an interesting, that's already interesting, right? Why doesn't the sun have anything to do with these guys' models? So, now the difference was Kepler understood that discovery lied in the act of cognition and, carrying out an idea, which he had, right? An idea that the sun actually played a role in the ordering of the solar system and in the movement of the planets, right? He also had an idea that maybe, because you have to ask yourself, now, if the orbits are perfect circles, like everyone of the time refused to believe otherwise, right? It was a big thing. Everything had to be perfect circles. Well, why is it that you have this type of inequality? If you see that retrograde motion every 2.5 years, well, why does it happen every, let's say 2 years and a month, why does it happen every 2 years and a month and a bit? 2 years and even more than that. It's not a perfectly equal cycle. But if they're perfect circles, wouldn't it be a perfectly equal cycle? So it's interesting. I mean, Kepler already had this idea that, you know, maybe they weren't perfect, that maybe the orbits weren't perfect circles. There's a nice quote to give you an idea of this, and this is the first thing he says in his New Astronomy, to give you a hint at what he's thinking about this. Who wants to read loudly?
Luke? The testimony of the ages confirms that the motions of the planets are orbicular. It is an immediate presumption of reason, reflected in experience, that their gyrations are perfect circles. For among figures, it is circles, and among bodies, the heavens, that are considered the most perfect. However, when experience is seen to teach something different to those who pay careful attention, namely that the planets deviate from a simple circular path, it gives rise to a powerful sense of wonder, which at length drives men to look into causes.
Right, so already here, the first paragraph of the book hints to his idea that maybe this isn't the case. Maybe these guys are all wrong. Right? However, when experience is seen to teach something different to those who pay careful attention, namely that the planets deviate from a simple circular path, it gives rise to a powerful sense of wonder, which at length drives men to look into causes. And this is...
This is chapter one?
This is the first paragraph of his book. Book one, chapter one, yeah. So, okay, now, with that in mind, when you're looking at what actually is occurring, here in the nighttime sky, what you're going to see is, if you follow a planet, you're going to see a change of speed. At one point, it's moving somewhat slower than it is at another point. So the planet kind of increases and decreases in speed. Now, how can you explain that? How does the planet know to do that? How does the planet know to stay on that orbit and to constantly change its speed at every moment? But better yet, how can the human mind know how the planet knows to do that? Right? And Kepler determines, or he hypothesizes that the change in speed is due to the orbit being on an eccentric, meaning that the power that moves the planet is not in the perfect center of the orbit, but slightly off center. And he also says that the power that moves the planet is the sun. And so that when the planet is closest to the sun, it moves faster. And when it is far away, receives less power and thus moves slower. All right, so this was another one of his hypotheses that the followers of Aristotle completely denied and assigned the change of speed of the planets to either demigods designating the planet and telling the planet where to go, or some special power that the planet in and of itself had, and that the planet itself, knowing more than man, knew how to speed up and slow down. So that's it. That's an interesting, difference there. So just to keep moving along here, one thing that does come up, which we'll be getting to, is that you'll have a certain investigation of the orbit. And looking at this phenomenon, right, because it wasn't, when you have a certain idea, as Kepler did, which wasn't completely known to be true, a hypothesis had to be carried out. And so what he does is, in order to understand how the planet knows to be doing this, constantly speeding up, slowing down, moving on an orbit that seems to be relatively the same, he divides the orbit into, say, 360 parts that would sweep out equal areas, right? And he comes to be able to tell from two observations of where the planet was and where it went to, how much time it took for the planet to get there. because the planet, because the orbit was divided into equal areas for equal times. So he's able to do this. He's able to say, all right, so I had this observation for May 12th, certain year, and had this observation for, you know, June 12th, another year. I can be able to tell how much time it took for the planet to get from A to B. But now the problem was that he wasn't able to do the inverse. Right? If he had a specific position of the planet and a certain amount of time, he wasn't able to tell where the planet was going to be. Right? So there's a certain irregularity and undeterminability of coming to understand the principle of change of, at every moment of the planet on the orbit. So now this is where he, you know, because of the understanding that the planet is constantly at every moment ceasing to do what it was doing and becoming and beginning to do something different, he said, and he is unable to answer this challenge, sets out and poses this challenge to future scientists, astronomers, and this is, he actually says this in his epilogue at the end of his book on the harmonies of the world. It's just this quote right here. You didn't need this part.
Insofar as it's like geometrical beauty, I extol the geometry to solve this problem. It is enough for me to believe that I could solve this.
That I could not solve this.
I cannot solve this.
Insofar as it lacks geometrical beauty, I exhort the geometers to solve me this problem. It is enough for me to believe that I could not solve this a priori, owing to the heterogeneity of the archenkensine. Anyone who shows me my error and points the way will be for me the great Apollonius.
So he understood that there was a certain harmonic ordering to this process. And also that the function of the change in position of the planet was due to that specific to being governed by that specific principle of harmony, and not because it was being pushed around by a certain point in the orbit. And so the challenge that he set out was actually to determine what the universal characteristic of this moment, this constant moment of becoming, was. And this is where the need for a new metaphor that could describe this change in position as a function of change was set forth and then taken up by Leibniz and his development of the infinitesimal calculus. So you get a sense of this dynamic process of discoveries like this that occur throughout time and then create the stepping stones for, you know, further development. Just to give you a sense quickly, we've done some people in our youth movement have done some pretty extensive work on the harmonies of the world, which is one of his greatest works, because despite having this challenge unanswered to him, he was able to discover certain harmonic orderings amongst the orbits of the planets. And, you know, one thing that he was looking at was the use of these Platonic solids, but he's looking at how the relationship of the distances between each orbit correspond to the relationship of the differences of the Platonic solids inscribed in one another. Which is very interesting. You know, that actually also correspond when you're looking at the change in speed from, say, one moment, the fastest moment of the planet on its orbit, to like the slowest moment of the next planet on its orbit, you'd also generate a relationship there which is proportional to certain intervals in the musical scale. So, I mean, we have a whole presentation on this, on video. Do we have some here, are you?
With us, no,
but you can actually get this online. We have a whole website on this. But what you're looking at, But what you're looking at is that the universe reflects a certain harmony, a certain harmonic ordering, which is knowable to the mind of man. And what Kepler found was that this harmonic ordering is reflects a certain relationship of, say, for example, at the time they only knew of six planets, but what he understood was this relationship of the six planets to the moving force, the center of the world, was similar to the relationship of what he called, or the Platonics called, Dionysa, or understanding, to nuos, or absolute reason.
Dianoia. Dionysus, that's something else.
So Kepler's a pig?
Right, but this is the type of thing. So when you're looking at that and you understand that the ordering of the universe, which is harmonic, is knowable to man in the same way that, and reflects a certain relationship, right? That the planet's relationship to the power that moves them is similar to the relationship of man's ability to understand the creator of the universe. Now, this is an idea which, these are universal ideas reflected in the Renaissance, the ancient Greeks, but also, for example, Bach, which is an expression of the same idea. Is that the Amadeus Quartet? Okay. You look a little young. Okay, so, and if you're going to look at any scientific revolution, in history, you're going to recognize these same ideas as allowing for this development of mankind to occur. So, Bach, who, just to give you a sense with the Jesu meine Freude, picks this piece up, which had been written after the 30 Years' War, where the population was in complete dire straits, destitute conditions, and we're now beginning to live again. And in the churches on Sundays, a hymn was played. It was a very well-known hymn. Isu mana hoida, mana sultans hoida, oh, 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 goes like that, sort of. And it went like that. It's constant. It's kind of the same melody that occurs through the whole thing. It's long with the same melody, actually. So people were very aware of this. They knew it. But now Bach picks it up, and he completely, what he does with the piece, you guys should really listen to both, because he completely revolutionizes the piece. And not only does he do it so that it's more beautiful, but he does it in a way that will make you more human. And what he does with it, in demonstration of these same principles that we're talking about, and a real phenomenal way of communicating these ideas, is he forces your mind to recognize the paradox. Or in other words, whether you're conscious of it or not, if you're listening, it will eventually come out at you, where you'll be in a sense challenged to find the identity of the piece in all the parts which were not presently known to you, because it does show up in a subtle way. For example, the original piece of Jesu meine Freude has, I think, 5 movements or so, and they're all the same melody. What he does is he, first of all, changes all of those 5 pieces, movements, so that they're using the third register, much more brilliant. He doesn't completely... he does. I mean, he changes them. We should just work through it one time. But what he does is he adds in between these pieces something completely new and different that people had not heard before. So, in a sense, the new additions are the otherness added in the Jesu, but yet still reflect somewhere inside them that same identity of the piece. Just as those 5 original pieces are changed, and so you recognize the identity and you automatically see the difference and otherness in them, the pieces which he adds, which are different, you can also come to find the identity within them. So I'd like to do an example with the Gute Nacht. Now this is... Actually, can you play the first chorale so people have a sense of the melody? And just hypothesize in your mind for a moment, this is the opening chorale. This is the first idea that you'll get of the piece. So it's somewhat gives you a sense of the identity of this piece. Now, if you can try and find that melody, which seems to be the identity of the piece, hold it in your mind for a moment so that we could see if you could find it again when we'll look at the Gute Nacht. You got the first chorale? Now, there are many more examples of this in the Jesu. Okay. Can you start at the end? This is very important to get the beginning.
Oh.
Did anyone get a sense? A little bit of.
Yeah, we get the melody.
What do you? Yeah, you did. Who else thinks they got the melody in there? Huh? Yeah. Wait, can you hum it?
No.
No. Okay. Can you hum it? I can't hear you.
I tried to play this.
He's ringing the second one.
How about you, Petros?
I was trying to catch it, but what he does, which is interesting, sometimes he ends off beat. And at the end of the first one, he ended on the note that wasn't similar to the one they started with. You know how a song usually ends on the note that it started
okay.
with? He ends up on a different note, an uplifting note.
Hmm.
The other thing is that you have the different voices which are playing different things. You know, the things you have under playing the, between the different voices in the second song, second part, which didn't exist then.
Yeah.
In the beginning, everybody was playing the same.
Yeah.
Okay, the second time, you have this motion of the whole, of the different voices.
Mm-hmm. Okay, why don't we play the first, you know, the Yuzumon of Freud, just that. What?
The same piece
at
the beginning.
Oh, really? Oh, sounds cool. Well, okay, let's just keep it at that. Never mind. You'll get a sense of the identity. We can go through this again. But what you'll hear, which is present, is this, "Hier so meine Freude." Something like that, okay? Now, let's go to the Gute Nacht.
Where we were?
The Gute Nacht.
Yeah.
The Gute Nacht is the new introduction.
Yeah.
The Gute Nacht is another piece, but you can still use it to look for the same idea.
It's gotta be. Mm-hmm.
Let me just go back.
Oh, that is one of the
This is us singing, by the way. Okay, this is fine. Put it up. Did you just... Oh, are you serious? Okay, well, look, for lack of time.
We do have a lack of time, too.
Huh?
We do have a lack of time.
Okay, well, look, just to give a sense, I mean, this piece is completely different now than what you originally had known as the piece that constantly occurred in your church. What you have now is Guten Nacht and all kinds of different things going on. But yet, something comes up in the alto line this time, which is Gute Nacht, O Wesen. It's the same thing as Is o meine Freude. Right? And so you have this identity presented in something which is different. Just as you are, you know, obviously going to notice all the difference that occurs in what you originally knew of as the identity of the piece. So, now that, you know, that's just an example, which is also reflected in the science of economics, you know, put forth by real economists, like Lynn and LaRouche. And also, working off Vernadsky's demonstration of the absolute difference between non-life and life as being governed by two different principles, right? That the principles governing the abiotic domain are different than those governing the living, the domain of life. LaRouche has shown that the principles governing the domain of cognition and mankind are also different than those governing life in like all other living creatures on this planet. And so, just as you would have one principle, say the principle of cognition, dominating in a sense that domain of being, and also impacting and changing and affecting the lower domain governed by the principle of life. And then the principle of life changing and affecting the principle of the abiotic domain, they're yet all operating under the same principle, which is governing the whole universe, this principle of creativity, all right, and harmony, right? Because we don't have three separate universes, one for each domain. Right, but we have one multiply connected universe, which these principles exist in all domains simultaneously. So now on that note, if we're going to be serious about taking mankind now into the next 50, 100, you know, 500 years, we have some real realizations and changes to do. Where, mankind, the future mankind, is going to depend on the development of, a culture which is able to recognize these paradoxes in order to come to make discoveries about the harmony of the universe. So, this is also, I mean, this is the type of passion that's going to drive you to want to discover what isn't yet known. And the simple fact that you know that you can come to know what isn't yet known to you, like Kepler says, it would drive men to look into causes and drive the passion for you to be creative and make these necessary discoveries, you know, such as those which will be needed in the domains of fusion and, say, space exploration. So, and then you have to ask yourself, I mean, how else are we going to make these discoveries? All right. Now, am I really pressed on time here? Like, how much time is left?
Well, I have a couple of questions.
Okay, well, because I can wrap this up in, like, you know, 5 minutes or so. Okay. I didn't realize the time flew. But, Yeah, oh, cool. All right, so, but one thing is that we're going to have to look at, and Matt brought this up, what are the current limits posed on mankind at the moment? What are the current limits posing a boundary on the potential for mankind's development? There you go. right, because as the physical economic conditions and processes in your economy approach a certain barrier, you know, converge on a certain boundary, if the introduction of a new technology isn't brought in, isn't applied, then what you're going to see is eventually a decrease in economic growth, or an actual negative economic growth, which is what we're experiencing today. So, therefore, in order for the future of mankind to actually be the result of, to actually be in a state of increasing well-being or the state of mankind's physical conditions to constantly increase, then we're going to have to depend on a science which constantly provides for more efficient technologies to be produced and discovered. And what you're going to be looking at is the production of the means of producing superior quality means of production. This is really what the underlying principles of economics should be, which depend on the discovery of new universal physical principles. However, you do have to also take in consideration that every new discovery of universal principle, although increasing the power of man to act in the universe, is also going to act as a future limit or boundary, which could potentially become a crisis as mankind's physical conditions start to converge on that boundary if new technologies and discoveries aren't applied. So in that light, think of the boundary that's approaching in natural resources. And what is going to be needed in order to discover new principles in the field of fusion so that we can actually generate new natural resources. Right? There's no real other option. But on that note, fusion power does seem quite exciting, right? For those of you that have looked at it, there are a lot of developments occurring right now internationally. Nations are coming together to invest in this new technology, which uses if you guys get a sense of you people have heard of plasma. Anyone not heard of plasma? Ilko. This is the direction that we're looking at. This is the type of potential that exists in order to, for example, use virtually anything, including our garbage, to generate elements, resources, basically, right? And there's a whole process that I won't go through right now. But this is the type of thing that allows for new potentials to be developed in light of an isotope economy, which Lynn talks about, right? Where you can actually use these elements generated now and change their atomic characteristics, their physical characteristics, like fine-tuning them, changing their weight, and you know, and due to that, create a whole new array of possibilities. There's something like 3,000 different isotopes rather than just 92 elements of the periodic table, right? And so this is the direction that we're going in, because this is what you, I mean, with these developments, you know, things like microchips, ultra fast computers, which we would all greatly enjoy in time. It's a little joke because we have ultra slow computers in our office. It's unbelievable. But anyways, right? You can do all kinds of things, like change the atomic weight of, say, a diamond, so that it becomes a pure isotope, right? One isotope, one element, and increase the strength or a hardness by something like 100 times, which is already the hardest element, hardest material. And so, I mean, think of the possibilities of that, and you use that at the end of a drill, what you can drill to, or the potential for infrastructure development, tunnel building, you know, things like that. You could just rip right through rock very easily. So there's tons of potential there. And this, I mean, the fusion development is already occurring. We've got this going on in France. You know, certain nations are looking at this development, which is something that's still in the process of being developed. It isn't completely there yet, because it's something that, for example, like a plane traveling past the speed of sound and thus breaking the sound barrier, will enter a new geometry. And we'll have to adapt to that new geometry, or, for example, it'll lose its wings, its structure, right? It will collapse. So what you're looking at when you're looking at plasma, the fourth state of matter, the hottest form of gaseous plasma substance, which is also what surrounds the sun. What you're looking at is a new geometry which we're operating in, and so this is the type of breakthroughs that are going to be which are looked at and which are going to be needing to be made in the coming future, where these scientists are looking at the characteristic properties that are ordering the processes that are occurring in this plasma in the infinitely small. Which, you know, if we look at these ideas that actually generate things like renaissances in history, are governed by the same principles that govern the infinitely large, right? So, I mean, these guys are working on a certain development to understand the harmonic characteristics of what's going on here, and this is the direction that we need to be going into, because this is the only fuel that you're going to be able to use to, say, launch a rocket onto Mars or Jupiter, right, or wherever we may be going in the coming, you know, few decades, or at latest a century, right, without taking up an eternity or running out of fuel. Because when you're running off hydrogen, you can actually refuel on, you know, you can refuel on Mars, you can refuel on the moon, ice, you know. So this is the type of thing that we're looking at. This is the type of space exploration, right? And what's required to do this is not just the use of hypothesis, but if you think back to being a very young child and looking up at the stars for your first time, you'll probably have this powerful sense of wonder of what's out there, and maybe even a thought or two of, you know, exploring what's out there. So it's in our nature to want to know this, right? It would be against our nature not to do this. And so this, I mean, this, it's only, it's a political question right now at this point. And it's a real political fight of whether or not we're going to be able to accomplish this for mankind. And this is why we need everyone to come out and organize with us and fight with us for these developments, right? Spend your summer organizing with us, working on these ideas, on Kepler, on Bach, and mastering these principles, right? Because we need to organize our parliament, the Congress, and all these governmental institutions around this type of change. Right now, not, you know, as a utopic idea, it would be nice to do that. You know, a renaissance does sound cool. But we better, you know, rather than hope for this to occur someday, actually actively ensure that this occurs. Right? And it truly is the idea of imago viva Dei, man in the living image of God, as expressing the principle of the creator of the universe, expressing the principle of creativity, right? Which, I mean, that is man in his most playful state, right? Man is most human when he plays in that way, as Schiller says. And that's our goal, right? To be human. And there's this last idea I want to leave you with. I'll read. Since we all die, sooner or later, for sane people, happiness cannot lie in reaching the state of death, but in our assurance of a happy outcome for having lived a life which contributed to the virtuous aspirations of earlier generations and to the benefit of other ones.